Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Tuesday. Today, we're going to talk with USCFootball.com beat writer and columnist Dan Weber about what's been going on with the USC football team. Short week. Already had a couple of practices Monday and Tuesday instead of the normal Tuesday and Wednesday. So a lot of stuff we can talk to, and we're going to get to a lot of your questions. Tons of questions you guys have sent in. We love it. Keep sending them in. Podcast at USCFootball.com. That's our email address. Or if you want to leave us a voicemail, call us 641-715-3900 extension 816-646. You can also go to our website, peristylepodcast.com. Click on the left side of the page from your device, your computer. You can leave a voicemail that way as well. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Inside Troy. You can go on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast, itunes.com/peristylepodcast. A lot of different ways to get a hold of us. We do appreciate you coming on, and we appreciate Dan Weber joining us. What's up, Dan? How are you?
Very good. I thought a really good practice Tuesday morning. Just perfect football weather, bright, sunny. Everybody, looked like they were really into it. If they, dodged the bullet, everybody was healthy pretty much to start. And if they dodged the bullet of, there were some late, issues, on the practice field. Khalil Rogers, Claude Talon, we'll see, where that goes, but we'll know a lot more tomorrow. But I think the good thing is you get a short week, even though then next week it gives you an extra day to get ready for Oregon. And it also gives you cold weather to get ready for cold weather. Why they get, who in the world schedules you for the cold weather games in November? It's like, why don't you go to Oregon in September or go to Colorado in September? It's just, especially if you're going to go and then play a night game. These are not ideal, scheduling situations, but at least, you try to make the best of it, and you take the short week this week and you get the extra day to get ready for Oregon. But then again, you got back-to-back travel weeks too. So, they kind of got the short end of the stick on this part of the schedule, it looks like.
Yeah, two back-to-back road games and two cold weather places. We're going to get to all that stuff. We want to talk about practice, Dan, and get to everyone's questions. Just wanted to thank our sponsor for the Tuesday show, Michael Moline Real Estate. So if you're in SoCal somewhere and you need some help selling a property, definitely check out michaelmolinerealestate.com. If you want to buy something, lease, you can go to michaelmolinerealestate.com or give him a call at 310-275-4688. He's a tried and true Trojan fan, Dan. We know him pretty well. You can hear his message too at the end of the show. But Dan, it's funny. It was a good practice on Tuesday, I thought. Tuesday was the normal Wednesday practice where they did third down and some of those kind of installs. But the interesting part is that Clay Helton thought Monday was like one of the best practices ever. And we were watching it and it doesn't seem all that good.
Yeah, my decision was he's grading on the curve because it was Monday. And, they didn't have much time to get ready for it. And they didn't have much time to get over the bruises and the bumps and what have you. So, for what you had to do, coming into a Monday practice. And I do think the competitive tone is set with the 9-on-7 run session. And they did really go after one another, in that. So you got to like that part of it, that there is that kind of, high level competition between a defense that is now geared to stop the run and an offense that's geared, to get the running game going. And there's a lot of pride on the line, with these guys. And, so that kind of competitiveness, the normal competition Tuesday going to Monday, I think is what, Clay was focused on.
Well, let's jump into these questions, Dan. We got a whole bunch of them. It's a wide range questions from all over the place about the team, about the Arizona game, about Clay Helton, about the coaching search. So we'll try to get to all of these. We appreciate everyone taking the time to write in. First one is, this is Perry from Kaysville, Utah. Longtime listener, love the podcast and your Pac-12 podcast. Great work, guys. Question for Dan. How come Arizona never gets called for illegal man downfield penalties? I counted numerous times where Arizona's offensive line was more than 5 yards past the line of scrimmage on pass plays. He said the rule is 3 in college, 1 in the NFL. Arizona's first TD should have been called back due to this. Is Rich Rod exploiting a rule that is rarely called in his run pass option attack? Not sour grapes against Zona, as this should be the ref's responsibility to enforce it, not Rich Rod.
I think that's a really good point. I think that run pass option really does cause problems for Pac-12 officials who tend to get overwhelmed in, situations where they're really fast breaking. And, for example, those guys are downfield, and if that quarterback pulls the ball back and takes off, they're okay. They're good to go. And they sneak down the field the next time, and they don't even know whether he's going to run or pass it. And let's say he pulls up and throws the ball. That's a really, really good point. And I used to notice that I thought Oregon got away with some of that stuff. I do think if you run, the run pass option, in the Pac-12, you've probably got a chance of getting away with it a little bit just because you're kind of in a, jailbreak situation where guys are going here and there. And, you probably wouldn't want to depend on Pac-12 officials to pick that stuff up because that's really fast moving stuff. And that's just not something you see the Pac-12 guys all over. They tend to, if the game is going really high speed, they kind of just sit back and watch. It's the only time you don't see them throwing their flags because they're not sure what the heck's going on. So, but you make a really good point that may be kind of a flaw in the way college football is officiated. If you are a run pass option team with a quarterback on any play can pull up and throw the ball,
I'm gonna have to take
before he gets the line of scrimmage.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a look at the tape. I didn't really notice that, so I'll.
I hadn't thought about it either. I used to notice Oregon. I thought had guys all over the place, and when you had a Marcus Mariota, he could do whatever he wanted, and then at the last minute. And at that point, I'm not sure anybody's locating where everybody is. We really need to take a look at it. That's a really, you have some of that this week, maybe not quite the same extent, the run pass option, but, there's some of that and, very good observation.
We had a couple of questions, Dan, about safety John Plattenberg, who didn't even start against Cal, didn't play a single defensive down against Cal, and then started and had some big plays against Arizona. But I'll read you both. This is first one's from Matt. He says, first, thanks for doing a great job. Many people are giving deserved accolades to Juju and Rojo for great games against Arizona, but I think John Plattenberg was the real game changer. His interception was huge in the first half, and maybe even more importantly, catching that wildcat on the open field on the broken kickoff return to stop a touchdown was huge. Instead of a touchdown, Arizona got a penalty and a sack and then had to punt. To me, that was the play of the game. Is Plattenberg getting the recognition he deserves for saving the Arizona game? That's for Matt. And then Earl in West L.A., can you give me some background on John Plattenberg? His interception to stop Arizona drive was impressive until he ran down the kick returner to save what could have been a touchdown. What incredible speed. What can you tell us about him?
Well, I can tell you this. He was one of the guys we were trying to locate to talk to after practice today, and somehow he escaped. wanted to really, get into that in terms of, he's a kid that went to high school for 2 years in Southern California and went to high school 2 years in Houston and came back to USC. A really delightful kid to, to talk to, very upbeat, expects a lot of himself. I think on the first interception, he would say that's a team play, because of all of the things that happened on that play. He was in the right place at the right time. But the second play, that was just unbelievable effort. And he is a kid that could, I think he ran track at least his junior year at Houston, Yates High School maybe. But he was a track guy his junior year, and he really showed it there. He's probably not got ideal safety size, but he's a tough kid, a strong kid, and I don't think we ever got exactly you know, the story as to why he didn't play as much, or, you know, he didn't play special teams, but no, you know, true defensive snap the week before. But he certainly was in the right place at the right time, you know, with Leon McQuay unable to go. And you're absolutely right. He just, you couldn't have asked any more, you know, for a kid, you know, to do the two things that that he did. And he was, and that's what, you know, they're hoping that, you know, guys make great individual efforts, but that they also play within the team concept. And that's what he did on both of those plays. And, you know, their kickoff return defense has been so good. I mean, the coverage has just been, and that's the one play that got away from them. And, you know, all you can do at that point is just somebody make, you know, that just extraordinary effort, and he did it.
We have, let's see, question from Mike in Irvine. He said, I thought our D-line was solid in the Arizona game, but they seem to rarely get a threatening pass rush. I think it's due in large part to the lack of speed on the defensive line and in the rush linebacker position. Is that a fair assessment? What efforts by the coaches, if any, have you seen to improve the pass rush? And he says, P.S., give a shout-out to my brother-in-law, John, from Long Beach. Hey, John from Long Beach. We were undergrads together at USC in the 90s, and he introduced me to his sister, who I married soon after. I told him about the podcast a couple months ago, and he has become a loyal listener, so we're even. Thanks for that, Mike, and shout out to John and your bride.
That's great. That's an even, you know, even trade, I guess. You get, you know, you get the wife, and he gets the podcast. Anyway, yeah, I don't think they have anybody, the seniors, with that, you know, that special acceleration that maybe you would, you know, they don't, they're obviously no Leonard Williams. Claude probably has, you know, the best, you know, 1-2 step. I will say this. I'm watching and I'm seeing much more emphasis on individual pass rush details where guys are, and, you know, the same thing's not going to work for everybody. And I do see them much more, you know, working with one another and working in one-on-one stuff, you know, in the pass, you know, pass, block, pass rush, drills. And, you really do see, more emphasis. And you see guys working on it on the sidelines where they're showing one another their swim move or, you know, their inside move or whatever. And, I would say you're right in that the acceleration, that burst isn't quite there. And, I think they were probably hurt by a scheme that even though we had heard was going to be more penetrate and more be on the other side of the line and play on the other side of the line of scrimmage, when push came to shove at the start of the year, that isn't what they were doing. They were basically holding their spot, getting double teamed. And, all of a sudden, I mean, what Antoine Woods did, I was telling him today, I said, you look like a linebacker. What's going on? I mean, all of a sudden, man, you are playing on the other side of the line of scrimmage. And, you know, you're tripling your tackles for losses for the whole season. So something's happening, and they know that if they produce up front, they're going to probably win the game. They really are convinced of that. And that's kind of a, you know, a thought in their minds that, they haven't had before. And so, you know, I think it builds on one another. And I think having the big bodied freshman behind them also working to get into the game, I think it's all, you know, working together. I do think, they're going to get better, but they need to. They can't allow, you know, the kind of time that they do, you know, at times. And, you know, they worked hard. They just didn't quite get there last week. But they did play on the other side of the line of scrimmage, and they did make a lot of plays on the other side of the line of scrimmage. They probably just didn't, you know, give Ani Solomon enough hands in his face, even though, you know, he didn't have great success when he just did the straight dropback stuff. But I do think it's an area where they know really, really matters, and they keep working at it.
Kind of along the same lines, we got a question from the G, which I love his questions. He said, making a team one-dimensional is essentially a trade-off. While the team limited the Wildcat run game, I think it was just under 70 yards net. The secondary was torched by Solomon. That approach made Ano look like a Heisman candidate. What would you do different in order to diminish the pass game while still being able to shut down the run game? I realize completely shutting down both is highly unlikely, but it's frustrating to see our team struggle with a team that was overpowered by others. I appreciate your feedback. I like the resolve this team is showing, their toughness, mentality, and physicality. Fight on, guys. The G.
Yeah, I would like to see a better technique at times in the secondary. And, you know, I like their aggressive. I'd probably like to see them play more man that allows them to give run support. I think they hit 60 yards in 32 carries.
Yeah.
So that pretty much, they were convinced if we stop the run, we win the game. It doesn't matter what they do. They won't be able to make enough plays to beat us with the run, pay us option, or if they force him to throw the ball all the time, that he won't be accurate enough. I thought they gave up some touchdowns that were too easy. They just didn't look like they had the coverage figured out, you know, right at all. But now, what would I do? I think maybe, you know, take a few more chances with the blitzes. You know, time it up a little bit more. Maybe you let Sua freelance a little bit more of the Troy Polamalu stuff, where you just have him coming from places that they absolutely, you know, can't scheme for, and give them a bad play. I think the idea that USC allows them to make two and three easy completions and move the ball down the field and flip the field fairly quickly, that can't happen. You gotta give them a bad play. You gotta, you know, put them in, you know, second or third and long. And I think they need to do that a lot more, and they gotta figure out what's the way to do that. And you probably gotta take some more chances. You gotta, you know, play aggressive, and you just have to be not afraid to do some of the, you know, the things that they have to do to make up for the fact that they don't have a Leonard Williams. And they've got, you know, guys with experience, who've been around a long time, and they've got, some big body talented, you know, young guys, but they don't have, you know, that necessarily exactly right mix, but, they're getting better, and just, you know, hope that they just keep getting better. And I do think they understand if they produce, in that front seven, especially that, you know, the front line guys, and they're playing more four-man front, which I'm surprised they started in a three and decided, oh, we got to go to a four. I don't think that should have been a revelation that they probably needed, you know, the four-man front, and they probably didn't need to wait quite that long before they did it. But, you know, those are kind of some of the things I think about doing.
We had the Catman had a couple questions. One, I think we talked about. He said, you know, about the Rich Rod's offensive line blocking downfield. So we talked about that on the option plays when passing. The second one, though, and I don't know if you remember this, and I don't, I'd have to go back and look, but he said the first series in the second half, what happened that caused Adoree Jackson to complain to the refs after he was tackled on the bubble screen? They said, keep up the great work, Ryan and team. Fight on, the Catman.
I'm not sure if that's the one where they pushed him out of bounds, and then still, I think somebody, because I think USC had already been called, if I'm remembering this timing right, I think USC had already been called for one of those, and then a very similar thing happened in almost the exact same place, if I'm remembering, it's the one right at the Arizona bench.
Oh, that was a kickoff. Yeah, like, was it kickoff, or? But yeah, USC, I think it was Justin Davis got thrown out of bounds, like into the bench area.
No, you're right. That was Justin Davis. I don't know what the Adoree thing was. I know that they were thinking that you don't call that on them, but you call it on us. I know they didn't like, you know, some of the stuff that was happening near the sidelines, but I'm not absolutely certain. I do vaguely remember a play with Adoree, but I'm not sure of all the details, but I know they weren't happy after, you know, the quick flag, that USC got that probably was incorrect. And then the, looking away when the kind of the same thing happened from, you know, when Arizona was on defense.
Here's one. It's kind of common. Paul says, "Hey guys, really love the podcast." I'm not trying to make fun of your question, Paul, but this comes up a lot. Love the podcast and the effort and time you put in each week. Question for either Ryan or Dan. Is there an understanding as to why USC is not handing the ball off to Ronald Jones 20 to 25 times per game? 8 yards per carry seems to scream ball control to me. Is it strictly related to the concerns of him in pass protection, durability or injury concerns, or do they have playing time agreements, arrangements with the other running backs? Thanks so much and fight on from Paul.
I think it's a little bit of everything. I mean, I think they feel like they really want to give Trey a chance depending on his health situation, and they know there are things he does so well. I mean, he is a great receiver out of the backfield. He is a great pass protector. He is a really good short yardage guy. So there are reasons why you would want to have a senior leader like Trey, you know, on the field. And there are reasons why you'd want to have Justin Davis on the field. He does some things that nobody else does. He's got, you know, the ability to go wide and the ability to change fields and change directions and all that. I think they're moving Ronald. I just think, to be honest, Ronald is better than any of us thought he was. I mean, we all thought he was really good. I don't think we ever believed he could be this good as a freshman. I just think it's kind of taking people by surprise a little bit. I think the run game, the way Sark schemed it out, wasn't absolutely ideal for Ronald. I mean, that, you know, the inside-outside zone and the zone read kind of has him going east-west. And he's a north-south runner. And he's a guy that, I mean, I think the thing that amazes people is that his ability to run it, you know, inside the tackle and to just keep running. And all of a sudden, boom, he pops out, you know, of a scrum. I don't think anyone knew that. You knew he was talented. You knew, wow, he's different. And he does things that it's hard to say, how did he do that? But I just think they didn't figure out a way to absolutely, I mean, he's averaging 8 yards a run, and yet he still has a number of plays that get blown up, you know, where he doesn't, you know, get a yard or two. And that probably shouldn't happen. They still haven't completely figured it out. I do think, though, the fact that they've got him, they had him, they wanted him to get 20 touches last week tells you the two previous weeks it was 15. So they're moving in the right direction, whether it's, you know, fast enough. But, yeah, there are some issues in his pass protection, and he'll admit that. There are some issues in him catching the ball. He didn't get to do any of those things in high school. They just gave him the ball. He's obviously, he caught the touchdown pass, so he's getting better. Pass protection, you know, I mean, to my way of thinking, you don't have to pass, you know, if you're going to throw the ball when Ronald's in there, you know, throw it to him. Do people say, okay, if he's in there, they're not throwing the ball. I just think I throw play action with Ronald in there where you're maybe not necessarily requiring him. You wouldn't run straight dropback stuff. You just run play action and run play action to Ronald. And, you know, at least that way you got a chance to block somebody because they're going to come to maybe try to tackle you. And then Cody's got extra time because of the play action stuff. But, I think there are ways they can do it. I think they need to do it, though, and you're right. They need to figure out a way to, you know, he's got a chance of popping any play that he has the ball. He got a chance, and he's a unique talent. And I think it's, you know, the way they started the year and the way the run game was and the way it is now, I think it's had to evolve. And I think they're going to get to more where you guys think they need to get with Ronald and his carry.
Speaking of the run game, Tarek had a quick one. Why did the Trojans wait until the second half to commit to the run game? The pass clearly was not there.
I think they wanted to run the ball, and Arizona did some things that they weren't ready for. I think when they were in the two-back set and they were going to run the ball and with the lead blocker and all that, Arizona committed to loading the box in ways in which, according to USC, Arizona hadn't done that all year. And that threw them off, and it took them a while to adjust. And it wasn't a matter of, they didn't do that until the second. I think, probably you've got T and Tui, Marcus Tui Asasopa, are the kind of guys, that are working on those kinds of adjustments in the offense. And I think it kind of took till halftime to get everybody on the same page as to what they were going to do. And that they would go to the three wide set, which would not allow Arizona to load the box, and run out of that. And they figured out how to do it. You would like them to be able to be nimble enough to figure out how to do that after the first series or so. And it got USC all, flummoxed in terms of what they were doing. What they, gained 12 yards or something in the first quarter and 224 in the second quarter. So, they adjusted and they got to where they were going to go. It probably took a little longer than it should have. And I'm not sure I would, say that, well, Arizona's never done that this year. You should do that. I'm thinking if USC comes out in the two-back set, I'd want to load the box on them. I mean, just because Arizona hadn't done it, you ought to be ready for the fact that they might do it because it makes sense if they, if they do it. And so that's where you'd like to see them have the ability for Cody to audible, run play action, and throw it to the tight end, dump it off, that classic rollout, tight end drop. That USC ran for so many years, it was money in the bank. I think they need to get there, but the way Sark had the offense set up to start the year, that wasn't kind of a staple of what they were doing and probably needs to be.
This is also one that kind of comes up often. Juju Smith, who was an absolute warrior, obviously playing just a few days removed from surgery. It's from Julian. He says, I got to watch the game live the other night, and man, what a good time. Watching live and with good seats, I noticed that Cody Kessler didn't even really look at any receivers besides Juju when he dropped back to pass. If it was that obvious to me, it must be equally obvious to opposing coaches. What, if anything, is the coaching staff doing relative to this tendency, quote-unquote tendency, that Cody has?
Went through his reads and came back to Juju. Who has the ability to keep running, who has the ability to dominate, physically, most people who are covering him. And so they work together a lot. And I think a big part of it is the receivers have to convince Cody, that they're going to be where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. I don't think he has to be convinced that kids like Deontay Burnett or, Stephen Mitchell, can catch the ball or what. I just think there's a certainty with Juju that he is not going to let somebody push him off his spot, or he's not going to allow, somebody to beat him to the ball when it's, it's in the air and all that kind of thing. And I do think it's a kind of a trust thing. Cody really doesn't want to throw an interception. I mean, you can say that about every quarterback, but he really, his track record is such that that's just something he's not going to do. It's one of the reasons, he doesn't get rid of the ball real quickly. He really, really wants to, take a look at everything that he, all the possibilities. I do think some of the patterns, they're not ideal. I mean, you don't see guys breaking free wide open. For what reason? I really don't know. I mean, to be honest, you watch the game, Juju is more wide open than anybody else. And you think, how is that possible? Wouldn't you think Juju would be the last guy who'd be wide open? But very often, he's wide open and you look quickly and you think, there wasn't anybody else wide open. I'm not exactly sure how that's happening. But, I can understand if I were Cody, I'd probably be looking for Juju too. like the other night, first play of the game, I thought it was good insight into how Clay thinks. First play of the game, they throw the ball to Juju. And I know people were saying, wow, that's interesting. Well, Clay's thought was he had only caught a few passes on Friday, and they weren't sure, where is he? What's he going to be like? So they were going to throw it to him right away to see where is he and how is he going to be able to play today. And, of course, that's the one he extended, made that one-handed, left-handed catch. And they figured, well, he's going to be fine. He'll figure out some way to catch it. And that's what he did. He caught the ball with his body. He caught it opposite of how he often catches it. And he just got such a dominant will that, it's hard probably to go away from him. But I do think the secret for Cody will be having the ability to throw it to all the other guys, and from now on, we saw today Deontay Burnett made an absolutely unbelievable play. Daquan Hampton may have dropped some balls, but he also made the catch of the day in a crowd for a touchdown. Just that has to happen more. I mean, there's no question about it. Maybe we'll start to see it Friday. I mean, Cody has had good luck against Colorado, to say the least. Over the years, and been able to throw the ball to a lot of different guys. So Friday might be the time where you see that happen.
Let's go to Jay in Yucaipa. He says, he said, Ryan, got a suggestion for USC. Maybe you could pass it along. Guaranteed to save the team some lost yardage. Here it goes. Whenever Helton feels like running a dumb bubble screen that's ultimately going to fail, just have Cody take a knee. That way we only lose 2 yards instead of 6 or 7. Good idea, right? Just needed to vent. Thanks from Jay and Yucaipa.
Yeah, I do think they need to block. They need to run those things like they're running plays, and they need to block them up better. And if you don't have the right guys, if you got guys that, aren't going to quite get there, or you got guys that are going to get overpowered at the point of attack, it isn't really worth running. You're right. And if you're going to take a while to get the ball over there, it probably also isn't worth doing. I mean, I just think you got to look at it as a running play, and you run it when, when they're dropped off, and, you got to know that they're going to stay dropped off, and it gives you a chance to block them and get 5 easy yards. But, yeah, you don't want to, if they decoy it and then they come up, immediately on the snap of the ball and they're flying across the line of scrimmage, it's probably, there's probably not anything you can do about it except, as you say, don't call it. they've had their moments. I mean, they've had plays where they throw that thing over there and next thing you know, Stephen Mitchell, they get a block and seal the edge, and Stephen Mitchell running down the sideline for a touchdown. I mean, so I think at times we don't credit them for the things they do well off the bubble screens, but there are times where you just want to tear your hair out, and I can understand that.
You feel bad for Deontay Burnett, who was the leading receiver for the Trojans, I think 83 yards on 3 plays. Against Cal, and then he had 1 catch for -6. Like, just he had no shot on that screen.
Yeah, he's the one that got blown up. I mean, they came after him with and I guess they decided they read that play absolutely all the way, and he had, you're right, that would have been better off taking a knee.
Here's a voicemail question. Here you go, Dan.
Hey, Ryan, this is Lindsay from Encino. This is for either you or Dan Weber. Want to get your thoughts on whether you think the less than convincing wins over Arizona and Cal will negatively impact Helton's chances for getting the full-time job. Well, I agree it's kind of premature to make full-on coaching predictions. It's hard for me to see Helton getting the job unless he, one, wins out, and two, does so somewhat convincingly. I know a win's a win, but we've looked flat more often than not. I will say I was proud that we made adjustments and were able to overcome a double-digit deficit in the Arizona game, which is something I haven't seen from our team in a long time. But still, both of these games have been closer and, I hate to say it, but somewhat sloppier times than they should have been. Do you guys agree, and how, if at all, do you think the way that we've won will impact the coaching search? I just want to say thanks for the awesome podcast, and a big shout-out to my husband, Matt, for introducing me to your podcast. It, frankly, is just the best out there, and I love it. So thanks so much for all you do, and fight on.
Really good question. And, you know, my take would be you keep getting W's, you keep doing things you haven't done before, like, you know, come back from a double digit, you know, starting, trailing double digits, or you come back and, you know, in the fourth quarter. I think those are all pluses. You know, being flat, this is a young team. They've gone through a lot this year. They probably don't, you know, I think it was hard for them. I mean, I think they did the Cal game wasn't as close, you know, as that final score. The Arizona game wasn't. I mean, there are ways in which they have the ability to kind of make it look, even though, you know, they're on offense at the end and all that. They have the ability to make it look closer than it actually was. I think those were two fairly, if they keep winning, those won't matter. All those will be, he turned them around, he got them going in the right way. They're playing hard for him, even if they aren't, you know, aren't very well organized at the beginning of the game, even if they're making mistakes and all of that. They're overcoming him. They're playing hard. I think they're net positives if they keep winning, and if they keep improving. But, you know, they're the kind of things you can look back at if you don't keep winning and say, yeah, see, I knew it was coming. So I think it might be premature to decide right now how they're going to impact him. But my take would be if they keep it going, those games don't hurt him at all. You remember the good things. You know, now there were games with Pete that we tend to forget, but there were a lot of those games where they just, you know, barely, you know, the Aaron Rodgers Cal game that mattered so much, and when he completed like 23 straight passes against USC, or the Arizona State game where they actually went into when Leinart got hurt in the first half and weren't sure he was even going to be able to come back in the second half, and they went into a hurry-up run offense with Reggie Bush and Lundell, and they played hurry-up by not throwing the ball. But those were games where people would have said, God, how did that happen? That shouldn't have happened. But those things happen, you know, in college football. And pretty much, you know, happen to everybody. And nobody worries. I mean, look at Ohio State this year. How many of those games they've had against teams not as good as Cal and, you know, in Arizona. So, you keep winning, they'll remember the wins.
Makes sense, and thanks for the question. We don't get a lot of female callers in there, Dan, so that's kind of cool.
That was a really good question. It's not an obvious answer, I don't think. I think it's one of those ones where the answer is going to, you know, develop. I mean, obviously, if you read the Peristyle, you know, by the end of the first quarter, they had Clay Helton eliminated as any kind of a potential coach. I mean, you know, so you just probably have to look at those and just say, okay, you know, the game's not over yet. The season's not over yet. Let's see how this plays out. But that isn't always the way people let it play out. They kind of want to make a decision right now. And I just don't think that decision's going to be made right now.
Well, hope I hear from her again. And Matt, thanks for turning her on. Let's Bearsecutor. This is a little long, but I'll read you along the lines. I'll read what you're saying. He said, Dan, a challenge. Can you think of a single scheme or in-game decision Clay Helton has made these past 2 months that is bizarre, inexplicable, or pathetic, like we routinely saw in the Sark Kiffin era? So he's talking about Sark and Kiffin. Helton is unfailingly clear-headed, upbeat, calm, focused, knows who he is and doesn't make excuses. You can disagree with his use of timeouts early in the to settle the team, forego the penalties on Arizona field goal to get the defense off the field, balance Davis and Rojo's touches, many bubble screens, etc. But in every case, he has had a consistent, coherent, plausible reason that he can articulate and acknowledges the specific context. Helton haters out there, in their understandable fever to, his understandable fever to restore USC football dominance, still need to acknowledge Helton is at least a B-plus head football coach. Only a handful of coaches slash teams have had a better past 2 months than Helton in USC. If he runs a table, he has to be in the top 10 and conversation for coach of the year, along with the coaches at Navy, Utah, Iowa, Houston, Oklahoma State, Florida, Michigan, Clemson, all of whom had no off-field issues. Anywhere from 6 to 60 times more time to work with their teams and were able to handpick all of their assistants. Sorry, it's kind of some long sentences there, but that's from Bear Secutor. What are your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're on the money. I mean, there might be times where they switched from running the ball to throwing the ball two or three times that I wasn't crazy about. But I wouldn't call him bizarre or whatever. I mean, nothing he's done, you know, approaches, say, the Boston College game last year, for bizarre approach to, the USC offense. Without the ability, picking it up in the middle of the year without the ability to pick your staff, having to deal with somebody else's offense, and even though you were calling the plays, it still wasn't your offense and all of that. So now he's doing what we thought was really difficult, was for, the head coach to also be the play caller. He doesn't have any choice, but I think you could give him a pass on maybe some of the slower adjustments. But the one weird thing is, unlike like last year at Boston College where they adjusted to the wrong thing, in the second half, he's adjusted, until it was way too late. But he's adjusting to the right thing, and they're getting there and, moving in the right direction. So, yeah, we were talking before the podcast with Ryan that if he runs the table, which would mean, obviously, you win these last three games, you beat UCLA, somehow Utah loses to UCLA, which would be the ideal, and you get into the Pac-12 championship game, and if you run the table until then, I think they've got a heck of a shot that they beat Stanford. If that's the case, you get to the Rose Bowl, and maybe you play Iowa. And if he runs the table, I do think he should be in the running for the coach of the year. I don't think there's any question. I think we said he could be 8-1, and 9-1 overall as an interim coach. I think we got the numbers right. But he couldn't not be in the running at that point. And he's done a lot of really good things. The players are so responding. And I think they're so grateful for having a steady hand, in charge and a steady voice that, he's got their back. They're cutting down the penalties gradually, but they're not overreacting, especially on the pass interference stuff and all that. If they think the guy's really working on his technique and, it's a matter of, a jump ball call and, they get the bad call. I like the way he's handled all of that, and I think Barrett's got, the right take on what he said.
We got a couple more. There's one more voicemail and then a couple emails, so we'll get through these last ones and end the show. Here you go.
Yeah, this is Richard from Toluca Lake. The question is for Dan Weber. Dan, on the ESPN last night with the SC game, Rod Gilmore, who was doing the color analysis, said he thought the three top guys for the SC job were John Gruden, Jeff Fisher, and Bob Stoops. I'm wondering if this guy is smoking something that we don't know about, and I would like your comments if any one of those three are viable, and if not, who do you think would be the lead candidate outside of Helton? Appreciate it. Thanks again. Love the program. Bye.
Actually, we are hearing that the third name, Bob Stoops, and it makes some sense. So we talked about this today, that I think it's really hard to get Oklahoma back to where Oklahoma was, and he, you know, got them kind of where they are, because the state of Texas, now that you've got Baylor and Texas A&M and TCU where they are, there are way fewer players to come out of the state of Texas. I mean, Oklahoma used to live on the fact that they could get almost as many good players out of Texas as the University of Texas could. But I think it's hard now to get those kinds of players. And I think when you kind of run out of, you know, and it's hard to get players out of California, the schools are doing a better job. And, you know, when you have a state like Oklahoma that's a pretty decent high school football state but doesn't have the numbers, and you also have Oklahoma State there that's doing a good job, you kind of run out of players, and you can be as good as you can be, but, yeah, probably can't win another national championship. You come to USC, you can win a national championship. So I think the Stoops thing is probably not wrong in terms of whether there's some interest, you know, that way. Gruden, to me, is, I just don't see that at all. I mean, you hear these numbers that he's being paid, like, you know, ESPN doesn't have that many really, really high paid people, and you keep hearing that his, you know, his salary is just as much as he'd be paid as an NFL coach. And you think, why would he want to give that up? I mean, do we know what kind of recruiter he'd be? I mean, do we have any idea? It just doesn't make, that doesn't make any sense to me. It just, nothing about it makes any sense. And I'm trying to think, who's the third guy, Ryan? His third,
I don't know here. I'll start playing this again and we'll see.
I'm trying to think, it wasn't Harbaugh, was it?
No, I don't think, here, I'll start playing the middle here.
And last night with the SC game, Rod Gilmore, who was doing the color analysis, said he thought the three top guys for the SC job were John Gruden, Jeff Fisher, and Bob Stoops.
Okay, Fisher.
Okay, yeah. You got to, you know, say Jeff Fisher, you got to think about him. I mean, I know that there are people who say one of the reasons he took the Rams job was that he always knew that there was a chance the Rams would come back to L.A., and so that gives him one way of getting back here. The USC job gives him another. Again, I just think Pete Carroll is so unusual that he kind of relished the competition that recruiting gave him. You know, he relished competition in every way possible. And recruiting was one of those ways. I'm just not sure that NFL guys, longtime NFL guys, would end up relishing the recruiting. I'd probably have changed my mind if they would have hired Jack Del Rio. The more I got to know Jack Del Rio, and the way he feels about USC, and you see the kind of job he's done at, you know, with Oakland this year, and I think he might have been a pretty good choice, and I think they maybe, you know, screwed up, but I just think it's so hard for me to evaluate NFL coaches when recruiting is, you know, so unbelievably important. Now you can say, well, USC is going to recruit for itself and you're in pretty good shape there. But, you really got to like it. You got to like that that competition. And that's something you don't have to do in the NFL. So I get nervous when people say, you know, it's got to be this guy or this guy or this guy. And they're like, NFL guys. I don't know enough. I don't know. It's not knowable.
Yeah.
For some of those guys, and you know, you're just gonna flip a coin. I don't quite see it.
Yeah, Ricky Ellison was on our show last week, and he said that he talked to Jack Del Rio, and Del Rio wanted the job, and USC, you know, he said it, we took it if USC offered him. So, or when I was, you know, a couple
years
ago.
Yeah, I think that was a swing and a miss. I mean, I think that would have been, you know, if you said, okay, we got Sark or Del Rio, the more I think about it, yeah, Del Rio was the way to go.
So we got one more coaching one and then a renovation one. Jamal says, hey, Ryan and Dan, why can't we go after a guy like David Shaw? Why do we need a spread shotgun offense? For the next 2 years, we'll have Max Brown, who is immobile and does us no good to be in the shotgun. He needs to be under center. He is 6'5 and can see over linemen. We need to go back to a physical power run. We play Alabama on the first game next year. That's Jamal.
Well, I think you can run the shotgun with, you know, Tom Brady's pretty good at it. Peyton Manning is pretty good, you know, in the shotgun, and those guys aren't going to, you know, outrun any of us. You know, I just think it's your basic approach. I mean, I do like, you know, the fact that they're getting under center more. I think that's a plus, and I like that kind of, you know, that's probably true pro style now is, you know, being able to do both and do them well and being able to run out of whatever you're going to, you know, whatever you're going to line up in. And you have to figure out, you know, those ways. And I see Max is kind of a, you know, a guy who can do the kinds of things that those guys are doing. And so I wouldn't run a read option. I mean, the next time, Peyton or Tom Brady runs a read option will be the first time, I think, in history. And so that seemed like a force. I didn't get that at all. And don't understand what the thinking was there. And we never did get an explanation of exactly what were you thinking? It didn't make a lot of sense. So anyway, that'll be my take on, I think Max can do everything, you know, that they need him to do. And I think if you get whatever coach you come in here is going to say he's going to do, makes Max the most effective. And I think, you know, I mean, you see, like, for example, when people talk about Tom Herman in Houston, they say, well, he's doing this. Well, he's got a converted running, you know, a converted, defensive back playing quarterback. But he had three different kinds of quarterbacks, you know, a year ago at Ohio State. If he did in one season, he did things for three different kinds of quarterbacks and he made it work for all three kinds of quarterbacks. I think that's what the good coaches are going to be able to do. You know, you don't try to pound a square peg in a round hole. You just figure out, okay, this is what he does really well, and this is how we can, you know, make him the most effective, you know, quarterback that he can be. And so you don't, I mean, you know, I think the guy at Navy is an unbelievably good coach, but you're not going to bring him in here. I mean, he probably is not going to be able to do that. He's going to, you know, run the triple option. And that isn't going to be what you want. But I can't imagine that they would go for anybody who's so locked into a system that doesn't fit the personnel that are here now.
And I can't imagine, Dan, somebody hiring, like, you make your decision based on a seldom used backup quarterback, as talented as Max Brown is. But if you're hiring because of, hey, well, Max Brown is this, like, that's, you're probably not making the right decision if that's the main reason behind hiring somebody.
Yeah, and it's the same way, you know, that you've got to say, oh, you can't bring this guy in right, you know, he won't get here in time and our recruiting class will be, you know, whatever. No, you can't, those kinds of short-term decisions. I mean, I saw somebody wrote that bring in, Kyle Whittingham because, he'll keep Sua around next year, you know. Okay, so, you know, he's part of the family, but A, Sua probably not going to be around no matter what. And even if that did happen, that's not a good enough reason if he's not the right guy. It's not anywhere near a good enough reason. There are a lot of, you know, good reasons to hire somebody, but, you know, for one player, it's not even close to being a good enough reason.
We got one last one on the Coliseum renovation from Steven. We'll get this under an hour. Not too bad. Dan, I think you're spot on with your comments and additional questions on the Coliseum renovation. While the proposal is priced at $270 million, could the USC/Max Nikias campaign goal to raise $6 billion by the end of 2018 be a factor as to why a larger, more extensive, and expensive renovation wasn't proposed? While USC doesn't seem to have any problem in raising money, could the larger effort to raise $6 billion be seen by university officials as having priority, making fundraising for the Coliseum project a distraction from Steven?
Good point. And I was at the Marshall luncheon today, and I think they announced that they're to $4.7 billion of the $6 billion. So, you know, they're getting there. And you do like it that half of that money is committed to scholarships. So that's where they, you know, how long it'll take to get into the Stanford, you know, area. I don't, or do you ever get there? But at least you're trying to compete there. And, I think there were like 60 scholarship winners at the Marshall, for the Marshall School of Business. And that's really impressive. But, I think it, you know, it makes the point that, that might have been one of the reasons that they said, you know, if we try to go for $500 million, is that asking a little bit much on top of this $6 million? Because they're making it clear, every dollar that, every dollar's worth of improvements in the Coliseum, the athletic department has to raise completely. And it's separate. And they have to, according to what they told us, they have to have raised it before it goes forward, that they've got to raise it in advance. So they need a big hitter. It certainly looks like they need a naming rights sponsor and a big hitter. Maybe can they get both? Can they get a big donor and a naming rights sponsor, or however they can do that? Can they name it, you know, to some extent after the name, can they name the field, let's say, after the sponsor? And can they name something else after the, you know, the naming, the person that gives them the big bucks, like the Galen Center? I don't know. But, I think they've got to do that. And I would say the $6 billion campaign is certainly a factor in, maybe scaling down a little bit the rebuilding. I mean, to me, it's a lot of the work is maintenance. It's not reconstruction of the Coliseum. And, they're losing good seats and they're not replacing them. And that's probably not totally acceptable right now. And I hope the fans make their will known there, that, and maybe, you know, step up and say, you know, we can raise that kind of money, and let's figure out a way to come up with, more good seats and give the Coliseum more than just a facelift.
Great stuff, Dan. Went about an hour podcast, but a lot of questions. We got to all of them, which I'm impressed with. There were so many. Thank you so much, everyone, for sending those in. And, Dan, great job answering them all.
Yeah, really good questions. Very good, insightful stuff. We got to encourage all of you to write those in into the Peristyle, too.
Yeah, get you on there.
Some really good insights.
Great. Great stuff, everyone. And thanks again, Dan. And everyone else, thank you so much for tuning into the Peristyle podcast. We'll talk to you next time. Probably do a solo podcast tomorrow at some point. No more open practices for the rest of the week. Of course, UNC plays Colorado Friday night. So that'll be a fun one. Check that out. And here's a quick message from our sponsor, Michael Moline Real Estate.
Most people know that buying or selling real estate is no small undertaking. Understanding the market value of your home, pricing, advertising, closing, and perhaps even selling personal property along the way are all examples of the real estate journey. And Michael Moline Real Estate has the experience to help make that journey an enjoyable one. Southern California real estate inventories are at historic lows, so there is no better time than now to sell your residential property. Whether you're moving into a bigger home or downsizing, personal property is often a component of the real estate transaction. Michael Moline Real Estate has industry expertise to help you with both your real property and your personal property as you get ready to transition. Michael Moline Real Estate specializes in properties located on the west side of Los Angeles and the southern San Fernando Valley communities. Allow Michael Moline Real Estate to give you a free comparative market analysis and home valuation so you know how much your home is worth today. Contact Michael Moline at michaelmolinerealestate.com. That's Michael, M-O-L-I-N-E, Real Estate.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on PeristylePodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.